Okay, so next presentation is by Stefan Untammer. He will give an overview about YAST and will tell how you do your own modules for YAST. I think that's a 1 hour presentation.
Yes, about 1 hour. It depends on you, on your participation, and on your questions, of course.
And then the next presentation will be held by Markus Meissner about SUSE and security. So, just if you're interested.
Okay, first of all, I would ask those people in the back rows to move a bit closer because I have to move to use somewhat smaller fonts so we have any content on the screen. Duncan, you come over, you have to see it. Yeah. It's one of our next generation YAST developers. Show exactly what to present, and the basic idea was, since there are so many open source developers around, maybe it would make sense for at least some of them to show them how they could use YAST technology to add features to their open source projects without having too much additional hassle for that project. Then it came to mind, okay, we could do a demo how to write your own YAST module in 1 hour, 1.5 hours with live editing and stuff like that. But honestly, I thought this was a bit too risky. You don't want to watch me hacking in an editor all the time and getting confused, jumping backwards, forwards, getting all kinds of syntax errors and so on. On the other hand, what I didn't want was to give you a lot of boring architecture details, EBNF of the language, stuff like that. That stuff can be important at some times, but okay, most of you I think are developers and you're not really interested in that kind of stuff. So I would say we don't do it like that. Forget about OpenOffice at this point. Let's get to some real code. That's why I asked you to come a bit closer, because this is what it's going to look like. Can everybody read that font? Okay. Because it will all depend on you being able to read that kind of information. Now, why would any open source developer want to concern with YAST technology at all? I mean, YAST is SUSE stuff. It's specific to the SUSE distribution. So if you want to do something for it, there has to be some added value for an open source project. But just think of it. There are so many open source projects around that have powerful configuration files where you can set up all kinds of things, only nobody can actually use it because it's hidden in some obscure configuration file that tends to change with every new release. Some of it may even be documented, most is not. Some features are hidden or are visible only if you read the sources. But most of those projects have simple configuration files like this. I just came up with a fictive scenario. You just finished programming that cool network game. And of course, a network game also has its network server, and the server has a server configuration. Now, would you want to write yet another GUI to let the site administrator change that kind of configuration? Probably not. Nobody bothers with that kind of thing because site administrators are supposed to know how to use VI. Only or a decent editor. Sorry, I had to add this.
Nice OS.
It's an Emacs here.
Nice OS, yes? Lacking decent editor.
I think it's possible if somebody shows me the right switch.
What?
I just got a request to turn off the lights on stage.
This one?
Like this? Okay. Okay. So those the kind of configuration typically looks something like this. It's a simple file format. It goes back to, well, people here probably would argue, but I think it goes back to the times of Windows 3.11, because it's a simplistic file format. Key equals value. What could be easier than that? Maybe some comments thrown in, emptylines.com, stuff like that. You have some miscellaneous information stored here that the server just needs in order to run or to do its thing. I only show this some very few values just to point out the principles. Of course, real-life configuration files would probably be a bit longer, be a bit more complex. They might have subsections, they might consist of several files, but for demonstration purposes, let's stick with this one. Now, handling that kind of thing is something that Yast actually can do very well. So, why not write your own Yast GUI to do that? Okay, why not? Because you don't know how to do it, of course. The first obstacle on that way is that most people stumble over stuff like Yast, or large portions of Yast are written in that Yast-specific own scripting language called YCP. The Yast engine, of course, is written in compiled languages like C++, mostly C++, part of it is C. But the reconfiguration stuff, the stuff you see when you work with Yast, is usually written in YCP. And, well, it's yet another programming language. Okay, people keep arguing, why invent yet another programming language to begin with? Let me just say this. It seemed like a good idea at the time, and now it's here, and we're stuck with it. But no, that's a bit too negative aspect, but we will get to see that it also has its advantages. But before we go into any more details, let me just show you a basic example. Hello World in YCP look like this. I think everybody who has some basic clue of programming should get the basic meaning of this. What is this all about? Okay, we have curly braces here, like in C or C++. This thing opens a block. Okay, that's also the first difference between YCP and most other languages. You need a surrounding block even for the outermost block. Okay, you get used to that. That's not so complex. Then we have very basic instructions that even point to GUI stuff at this point. It says open dialog, so obviously a dialog is going to be opened at this point. And then we have a thing called VBox, which is a vertical layout box. This is something that most GUI class libraries have, and I think most of you should be familiar with the concept. It simply means put one item under the other and handle them, well, like you see fit. Of course, we don't use fixed pixel coordinates because, well, fonts may change, languages may change, and so messages may change. So it all has its layout engine and layout logic. You simply say, okay, put one item under the other, and that's it. Then here we have a label, a static text in the label says hello world. And the next thing is push button with okay on it. That's it. That will give us probably a dialogue with, well, a text and a button underneath. Then we have, in normal GUI programming, at this point you would fire off this thing, and then you would go into your event main loop. If it's called X main loop, QT main loop, GTK main loop, whatever, you have some kind of main loop where you wait for events. This has its advantages, but it also has its downsides, because if you do this kind of thing, when you create a GUI toolkit, you need to handle your control flow radically different than you would with ordinary scripts. You typically have to set up event hooks, so you have to react when the user actually clicks on a button, and you set up all kinds of tiny event handlers that handle these things. But these things tend to break up the control flow in your program. So you always need to be aware, okay, this event occurs, and then this handler is called, which calls that handler, which sends off this event, which triggers that event handler, and it can get spaghetti code really quick without even noticing. You can get spaghetti code without GoTo with this kind of event handling. This is why Yast and YCP follow a different approach. You simply say, okay, handle user input here, and then we react. We will see later how we react. And then when the user is done, close the dialogue, and then it's over. Okay, no big deal, of course. Let me run this. Okay, no big surprise, we see hello world here. Okay, I mean, any idiot can do that with any graphics toolkit, that's no big deal. But at the same time, we also get a text-based version of that for free, because this is what Yast was designed for. We can also run it in the next term and curses. And the same thing happens, and you don't have to spend any extra work for that, because this is just a side effect of it. We describe the dialogue logically, so the UI engine will handle the rest. This is an additional benefit you can use when you use the Yast toolkit for stuff like that. Now we have to get rid of that again. Oh, okay. It's easier when the window has focus. Okay, just to prove the point that you can actually do that from a normal shell is you call the YCP interpreter Y2Base. This is the basic process that is actually being used. I call Y2Base, then the name of the script, I prepended numbers, just, you know, basic times, so they're ordered in the right sequence. And then I say QT for the QT version, or incursus for the incursus version. This is what you actually call when you invoke Yast from the command line, from the control center, and so on. The graphical Yast control center, you may know, is nothing more than a really dumb QT application that does little more than read desktop files and start Y2Base with an argument like that. And again, it comes out like that. Okay, now, okay, opening Hello World, of course, is a very simple thing. But what would we want if we go back to our configuration file here? Let's keep that open. What we want here is also a dialogue, only with more stuff in it. Just so we can see both at the same time. Again, we also have open dialogue, and well, we just arrange items under each other. So I also, again, have a VBox. And then I began enumerating all the fields I want to edit. And, well, I have a widget called text entry here. This, well, it's an input field for basic text. It's the most general kind of input field. And I also give it a caption so the user knows what he's supposed to enter here. I have lots and lots of text entries here and one push button with a click. I also have a thing called checkbox. Okay, that's an on and off switch because it doesn't make sense to have the user enter yes or no in a text field here. So I use the correct widget to begin with. One thing that might come to mind immediately when you see that is, what on earth are all those crazy backticks supposed to do? This is a special data type. This is specific to YCP called YCP term. A term is nothing more than an expression that looks like a function call that has an identifier in front and a whole lot of arguments. And it turned out that this is a very good way to specify trees when writing down code, because they have this inherent tree hierarchy that just comes with the parentheses, and you can nest them to any degree. This is a very natural way of writing down trees. Only for internal purposes, I don't want to go into very many details for that. For internal purposes, this is not really a function call. This is really just a way of writing down what is supposed to happen later. We get to that when we see the architecture diagram. Okay. When we're done with it, this is the matching parenthesis for that one. There's a semicolon. Again, user input. So let the user enter stuff and then close the dialog. Let's run this one. It doesn't look very pretty yet, but it does its job. So I can enter stuff here, but I can enter random nonsense in any field. And the password field shows the password in plain text. Okay, it can be argued whether or not this is a security hazard at this point, but we should really avoid that. And also, the maximum number of players that, well, can get random text that's not very pretty at the time field. There are numeric fields, and we really want the correct kind of widget that has some restrictions for input for that. So let's extend it somewhat to use some specific widgets. You see here, okay, I also added a heading that gives the user some information what he's supposed to do here, but I also used some more specific widgets for that. The int field is an integer input field with up and down arrows and so on. It also has a minimum value and a maximum value and a default value, which only makes sense because, well, I looked up in EDC services what port range is usually available, and this is available, so I don't want the site administrator block the HTTP port or anything stupid like that. This is something that can easily be avoided, and this is the basic reason why we want the GUI in the first place, just to make some basic sanity checks. And this is a very primitive sanity check, so we can easily do that in that form. Also for maximum players, okay, a network game with only one player is not really networking, and 999 is probably a bit much for most practical purposes. It won't be very much fun to play on that server with 1,000 players. But if the administrator thinks he has a machine powerful enough, let him do it. Also, respawn time from 0 to 1 hour, okay. And the password now has a specific password widget. Let's run this one. It it looks a bit more pretty because it has a heading, and it's actually surprising that stupid things like this can make the dialogue look a lot more appealing. But it's no longer a very stupid editor with random text fields. It also says what purpose it has. And you can see, we even have some default values for the fields where it makes sense, the numeric fields. And when I begin typing in the password, there's no real echo anymore here. This is why we have a specific widget, of course, for that. And also added on stuff like this paradox behavior and so on. Of course, again, we can run this with incursors just as well with no added work. It looks like that. It's not very pretty, okay, but it works. We will get to make it pretty later. So, a bit of mystery to most users how to work the spin boxes. It's arrow up and arrow down. We don't only want to display the widgets, we want to do something with them. And that means at some point we have to get the values out of the widgets or to put some values in. But that also means that we have to identify each individual widget. So each widget now has to get an identifier, an ID. This data type, again, is something YCP-specific. This is called a YCP symbol. This is a slightly more efficient way to store strings. It could be compared with enums in C, but it's not actually the same. Internally, those things are stored as strings. It's a bit more more efficient. They consume a little less memory, and it's when you have gotten around to get used to it, it's easier to read that kind of thing because you recognize, okay, this is an ID and it's not the caption of the widget. But since this again is a term, we could put basically anything into it. We could use an integer value here or a string. Even more complex data structures, but this is not the way it's supposed to be. But this is very generic. The widget will be identified later again by the same thing that that is here in that ID term. Okay. Now, I'm going to go back to that again. It still looks the same. It has a slightly odd look to it. This thing shouldn't be centered. Of course, when I only have a V box without any further specification, it can't know any semantics of your widget or what would be nice to look at. So the default behavior is that it centers things and it extends the size of widget whenever it's possible. Yes?
A quick question, maybe I missed it in the beginning. How do you get the hotkeys?
The hotkeys are at this point added automatically. You can specify them, and you should specify them as a matter of fact, with an ampersand somewhere in the widget caption. But usually those texts are being translated. And the translators usually don't stand very much of a chance to see the dialogue in its final version before it gets out to release on CD. So what kept happening to us in the early years of Yasp was that that we had dozens of bug reports that there were duplicate hotkeys for widgets. And of course, we can't handle it because we can handle the English version because the original source is in English. We can't handle the German version because most of us speak German. But we cannot handle the Dutch version, the French version, the Czech version. the Thai version, the Chinese version, and so on. So this is something the translator would have to handle, but they don't have a chance. So the default behavior is you can add an ampersand so you can get the letter of your choice. This is something easy to memorize, probably, like, for example, the T for time here. And if you know that the T already is used somewhere else, don't use the T, use something else that's easy to memorize. But this is decision you have to make as a programmer, or the translator has to make it. But then what's happening is that we have an automated mechanism that calculates those shortcuts so they are actually unique. And if one is not unique, then one of those widgets gets another shortcut reassigned. And in that process, when the mechanism detects that some widget doesn't have a shortcut at all, and it could get one because there are still letters free in the alphabet, then it will assign one. You will get a warning about that in the log file, but it works automatically. I simply omitted that for simplicity reasons for now. Okay. Any more questions? Yes?
Another question regarding the translation of the dialogue. Must I translate the YTP language, or is there some kind of meta tool like Qt?
We use simple gettext. So what we do is we extract the strings with xgettext, like all open source projects, and we, for production versions, you would use underscore parenthesis and then the text and then another parenthesis. I also omitted that right here for simplicity reasons, but yes, we do that, and of course it should be done. But it's a good point. Any more at this point? Okay. So, this is not aligned as we would like it to be, and we could use some margins around, maybe some spacing and so on. Let's beautify this a bit. Then, only then the code doesn't look so clean anymore. I excuse the indentation here, but I had problems with that resolution at that point, so I had to break my usual style here. I simply put all that stuff into a widget called margin box, which adds some margins horizontally, vertically. Okay, that's really cheap. I also added a spacing between the heading and the rest. I left aligned the checkbox, and I added some more spacing here. Okay, you see numbers here for all these things. You might think those numbers will get a problem concerning portability between Qt and Encursys, and also when you think about different screen resolutions and things like that. Those numbers are all normalized to do what you would expect under Encursys. Under Encursys, you usually have an 80 by 25 terminal window, and this is what all those size specifications are normalized for. So in Encursys, you would get two blanks left and right, and, well, one third of a line around it. Of course, you cannot display one third of a line, so Encursys will simply omit that, but in Qt, you will get a few pixels margin. Also, the spacing, it will simply leave an empty line in Encursys. This one, okay, I don't know, will it run up or down? That spacing might go away. We will see. I also added another push button to cancel. Of course, there should be more than just an OK button. There should also be a cancel button as a safe exit from this thing. And I want those buttons to be arranged beside each other, so I put them into an H box. Of course, that's the horizontal counterpart to the layout box. It will put items side by side. You can add any number of them until the screen is filled. Let's see what this looks like. Slightly better, I would say. But still, not the usual just look and feel. We will get to that. Now, what we want is to put those things into the standard frame that normal YASP modules are using. The thing we call the wizard frame, the wizard layout. And this is where those specific YCT data types really begin to make any sense. Because in the previous example, I simply, let me get back to this one. Oh, I omitted that one, intermediate step. In this example, I put them all right into that open dialog statement. But as you can see even with this example, you will run out of horizontal screen space very soon because you want to indent some and you still want to see the structure of your code. And decent editor probably will indent, so it matches with this parenthesis and it looks just about like this. So you want to modularize that thing. For example, you want to pull the button parts out. And this is now where we want to make use of those YCP data types. At the same point, you can also really modularize those things, give them logical names like this is a button box because it's a box with buttons in. So if you see it in your layout code, you can, it's much easier to rearrange it if the designer type guys, the usability guys demand that it's being arranged in some other way. So at first here I have a term describing my input fields of various kinds, like we have the for in field, checkbox and so on. That's it. Then in a separate term, I have my button box with push buttons around. And then the open dialog statement begins to become a bit easier to read. We open a dialog. Let's begin with the inner part with a VBox with a heading. I pulled out the heading from the field because it has no logical connection. Then I have spacing, the fields stored in the variable of type term called fields, another spacing, in the button box, again, stored in that variable of type term. And all this thing I put inside a margin box. So this is how you usually design and create those things. You begin with the stuff you need, which in this field, this case would be the fields. You extend it so it makes sense to you, and then you add the buttons you need, and then you make it beautiful. Then you begin to add spacings and margins and stuff like that, alignments, center, left, whatever you like. It doesn't work any other way. People who are used to use GUI generators usually also do it the very same way. You cannot program it like that, begin with a margin box and so on. You program that from the inside out. Usually. Okay, again, then we do user input handling and close the dialog in this case, because there's not much really happening at this point. With modularizing this, however, we can migrate this thing to the wizard look and feel very easily. Because we already have the dialog contents, the fields. It's the same code block I showed you a minute ago. The wizard, if you remember what it looks like, let's just run this example so this doesn't get too theoretical. A wizard looks just about like that. It has a help panel on the left. It has some dialog content. It has a wizard heading. And it has wizard buttons. This is only a one-step wizard, so technically it's not really a wizard, but it has the same look and feel. And this is what we want to achieve with this example. So the user gets the same experience when he uses that module, and he gets when he uses any other YASP module. So what the wizard needs is, okay, of course the wizard has its own call to open a dialogue. In this case, I open an accept dialogue. This is how we name that thing. It's a dialogue with an accept button and a cancel button. It's called, it's accept in this case because we, for that layout, we always want to have the positive button, the button that actually does the thing on the bottom right corner, which is not quite consistent. If you think of usual OK and cancel dialogues, usually you have OK as the first button, cancel as the second button, because the way we read things in the Western culture is we read from left to right. So usually you want the positive thing to be the first thing, because this is the usual one. OK is the usual action for a dialogue. And then come all the negative or unusual things. It will usually be okay, apply, cancel, but cancel is always the last. With this logic, we had to change it slightly because, again, it's a usability thing. It has to be to do with our Western civilization and culture, because our reading direction is left to right. So if you continue, you always move to the right. So the next button always has to be the right button, and the back button also always has to be the left button. That also means that in a wizard layout, it's always back and next. You, whatever spacing you have between those buttons, but the back button is always the left and the next button is always the right. That means the positive button, the do it button, is the right one. It's usually in the bottom right corner. At least that's how it's done in Yast. And this is why we have that accept button also in the bottom right corner. So it's consistent within Yast, at least to some degree. And we don't want to open yet another reason for surprises for the user. In user interface design, the most important factor is minimize user surprises. Do what the user expects would happen. So we have the accept dialog here. Then we have a call called set contents, wizard set contents. The call receives the dialog heading, because every wizard dialog is supposed to have a heading. Otherwise, what should the user think he's doing here? And then we have the dialog content. The dialog content in this case is a margin box with, well, 10 blanks left and right, 0 above and below, and then our fields here. It also gets the help text, because this is something that every wizard dialog should have. I omitted it here, but a real dialog like this should have a help text, of course. It can be a multi-paragraph help text. It is formatted with basic HTML, with less than P, greater than, and so on. You know how this thing works. Then at this point, I specify, this is a remnant from, this is basically for a few reasons, we wouldn't actually need it for this kind of dialogue. But this says, in a multi-step wizard, it says, okay, do I have a next button? Or is the next button enabled? Can I go back? Is the back button enabled? In this case, I want my cancel button enabled, and I want my accept button enabled. So both are true. I forgot. To use wizard, we have to import the wizard module. This is a hint to some other kind of Yast architecture. Of course, it can be modularized, and there is a large number of modules available. As a matter of fact, this is why I chose this approach to demonstrate this, because it's very complex to dig deep into that framework of all the available modules that we have at this point in this time frame. I think it's a lot more natural and easier to get into the topic using a simple example and extending it. You can read up the documentation for all the modules we have on our documentation server. We have a project page on forge.mobile.com. It has a URL like this. So what I would ask you to memorize is yast.zuse.com. You will get redirected to the right place. And there is all where all the documentation is. Okay. Let's run it once more. Of course, the widgets behave like they should be. I cannot enter random text here. I can only enter numbers, and I can only enter numbers that meet the restrictions here. Because when I hit more now, then I cannot leave the range, of course. That's the basic idea of this infield widget. And so, just so you believe that you can actually do this with incursors too, let's run it with incursors once more. Even with incursors now, it begins to look halfway okay. It's still text-based, of course. It doesn't look as pretty as a graphical user interface, but some people prefer this to the Qt version. They think it's faster, more efficient, whatever. I can assure you it's no faster, but people want to think it's faster. And so if people want to have it, let them have it. It comes at no extra cost. Now, at this point, we do have to get into the architecture a bit. Because otherwise, it's going to be really theoretical. What we have right now is a mechanism to display those fields. Okay, that's a start, but I don't know. Okay, full screen. But that's only part of it. Of course, much more important is how to read that stuff from file and how to store it to the same file at some later point. And to explain that, I have to point out the basics of the YAST architecture. I apologize for the font size here, but you see, since the architecture is a bit complex, that many elements are needed, I try to read it out loud, so because I think all of, except the front row, cannot read this. But what you usually want to do with any YAST module is do something on a machine that we call the installation target. For installation, of course, it's obvious. This is the target of the installation, the machine that gets installed. But it's also the machine that is being configured. This can be the same machine that your YAST module runs on, but it doesn't have to be. This can also happen remotely. There are protocols that make sure that the communication flow keeps up, even if this is a remote machine somewhere in your network. This is especially important if the machine you try to configure doesn't have anything else than a network connection. Of course, then you need to do it like that. That can be done via SSH and so on. I'm not going to go into any details, but this is one logical subsystem of this. This subsystem, the installation target, is handled by something we call SCR, the System Configuration Repository. This is the subsystem that handles all access to that machine. That can be simple stuff like reading etc fs tab or etc password key. But it can also be a lot more complex, and it can go so far as to hardware probing. Why should every YAST module learn how to do hardware probing just to find out, okay, do we have a floppy drive? Do we have a CD-ROM drive? Does it make sense to present that to the user so he can select something from his CD-ROM and things like that? This is handled by the SCR. The SCR accesses the system with things we call agents. This is basically very simple
programs or plugins that do one specific task to handle one specific part of the target system. For ETC FS tab, for example, there is an agent that handles FS tab, that can read FS tab and that can write an FS tab. And the caller also only needs to know, okay, what kind of data have to go back and forth. It doesn't need to know the file format. It doesn't have to bother with parse errors when the file is corrupted, or know how to handle the format when it writes the file. Historically, those things are single files in the simplest case. It's also the most common case. EDC FS tab is one single file. Passwd is one single file. Sysconfig keyboard is one single file. So the most important argument that is being passed to any agent is the path to that thing. And for some reason, the delimiter for this kind of path, the SCR path, is the dot. It's not the slash, it's the dot. But other than that, it's just a path. The difference only that the concept is being extended, so it all also includes things like hardware probing. We have a path called dot probe. It also has its own sub-hierarchy. We can probe the keyboard, the mouse, hard disk controller, hard disks, hard disk partitions. So you can see the path gets longer and longer. Of course, first you probe your controllers, then you probe the hard disk, then you probe the partitions. So we can present them all in a tree-like structure. This is basically what the partitioning module is all about. So that was one reason why we don't use simple file paths, because we extend the concept to also include other things that are not directly mapped, that have no direct counterpart in the Linux file system. This is the SCR. The SCR handles only four calls actually. It handles read, write, and execute, because some things are simply being executed. If you want to run a shell command, you would use the target bash agent. It knows how to do something with the bash, the shell, on the target. But of course it doesn't read the shell or write the shell, it executes the shell. This is why we also have an execute call. And for navigation in this structure, we also have a call that isn't mentioned here. This is SCR dir directory. So you can basically navigate just the way you would in a file system, with reading directories, presenting the user what's there, and navigating into one specific path, navigating back up, and so on. Okay, one subsystem, the target. On the other side, we have the user. The user wants to communicate with the system with some kind of user interface. This can be X-based, Qt like we saw it. But it can also be a simple text terminal or an SSH session, a screen session, anything. So we have, on one hand, the Qt part that already communicates over a network protocol, the X protocol. On the other hand, we have the incursors part, which might run on the Linux console, or the serial console, or over the network. So again, we have a network layer here, a possible network layer. This is all being abstracted, as you could see, with something we call libyui, the YASP UI. This is the abstraction layer where we describe the dialogues in a logical way. We don't have to bother with incursors calls, Qt calls, or whatever might be upcoming. Maybe sometime there will be a web user interface. This idea keeps coming and going all the time. Maybe sometime somebody decides that it's worthwhile to not only have a Qt UI, to also have a GTK UI, whatever. This will not bother that part. It will also not bother all the YCP scripts we have. because communication with the rest of the system is being done with YCP data types. It's the same things we saw in that little YCP script we just had. Of course, there are basic things like strings, integers, booleans. But there's also more complex data types like, well, the SCR paths that are being used here. It's actually a whole new data type to make a difference between strings and paths. There's also all those terms, because from the YCP part to the UI, the information has to be passed somehow back and forth. This is the explanation for all those crazy backticks, because this part, the YCP interpreter, doesn't actually interpret those things. It does some basic syntax checking, and then it simply passes on that whole term to the UI, and the UI knows what to do with it. So this is a whole closed, self-sufficient subsystem that handles everything UI-related in its own way. Okay, that leaves us here with libYCP, the YCP data types, and we have the YCP interpreter that, well, interprets things, basic parser, of course, control structures like if then, while loops, stuff like that. This thing can handle YCP scripts, but it's part of a larger subsystem called the workflow manager, which since 1.5 years or so, can also understand Perl scripts to some degree. Now just don't get overexcited about that. You can write just modules partly in Perl, but still, the user interface description is being passed in YCP data types. We did make attempts to wrap those dialogue descriptions in a way so you could write them down in Perl as well. But Perl doesn't have the kind of data type we would need for that. There is no real equivalent to a YCP term, no tree-like structure as a data type available in term. As a matter of fact, even if you do simple things in Perl, you have to resort to references pretty fast. You can't even nest a hash in a list or the other way around, or a list in a list. You need a reference at that point, and this is when it becomes messy pretty quickly. And when you try to write down a dialogue description like that, with this kind of tool, you need multiple calls for every little thing, and it doesn't come very naturally. This is why we decided, okay, it doesn't make very much sense. Let's leave the dialogue descriptions on the YCP side. But still, if you want to do extensive file manipulation, text file parsing, regular expression matching, things like that, this is something that Perl can do very well. And where there are lots and lots of tools available, let users do that in Perl and wrap that thing inside a small YCP script that handles the dialogue stuff, because this is something that YCP can do really well. Okay, and you never know what other language bindings might be there. Maybe somebody someday comes up with a Tickle binding or Python binding or whatever, if somebody has time. Okay. Here we also have installation sources, because that's I just want to mention it for the purpose of completeness. This is where during installation the packages come from, because they're not on the target yet. They're not within the YCP part. They're on yet another subsystem. This architecture diagram has one major flaw. It does not mention the package manager. We would require 2 or 3 more dimensions in the diagram to display that properly, and I decided to rather leave that out than to confuse everybody. Are there any questions so far about the architecture? No.
Okay, continue. If I somehow can get rid of this Acrobat. Hello. Okay. Now, we still face the problem that we have now have a dialog description that has widgets, but nothing really happens with those widgets. Now I mentioned the agents. An agent is typically something that handles some file format in some manner. It can be written in C++. You can write your own parser for initfiles for any kind of file format. You can use LexYak and whatever. But most of the stuff you usually need is already there. We have a number of powerful agent construction kits that can handle most of the usual file types that you will come across on a typical Linux system. Of course, we do have a ready-made parser for the initfile format because we have dozens and zillions of them around. Everything in etc sysconfig is in that file format. So yes, it knows very well how to deal with that kind of file format. And all you have to do to use that is to write a file like that, a file that describes the path you want in the SCR path you want to have in the SCR hierarchy. In this case, it's I simply named it like the real file path in the file system. etc sonic underscore server underscore conf. Okay, there are certain syntax restrictions here. You can't use any crazy characters, you can't use minus. That path should better not contain a dot. So basically the convention is we replace all crazy characters with an underscore. Yes?
When a directory path contains that, for example, system mirrors slash conf.
And we usually use an underscore. This is only a reminder. It doesn't have to be the exact path to the file because this is what you specify here as a string, with usually string conventions. So what we're using here is a shortcut, two shortcuts actually. We have the ini agent. The ini agent knows how to deal with the ini file format, as the name implies. Key equals value. But it also knows how to deal with other file formats that are similar. It also can handle xorg config, for example, where you have key whitespace value. It's just a different regular expression. So one part of using this is specifying the regular expression for the key, the regular expression for the value, and for what's in between. As simple as that. But it can also handle stuff like sections. If you remember what an xorg conf looks like, it has a section something begin, then a number of values, section end, and you can have a large number of those sections. The ini agent can handle that as well, but of course when you have that kind of thing, navigation in that thing becomes somewhat more complicated, so you need to do more complex things to navigate from one section to the other, because you have to specify, okay, now use this section, do something with that section, leave that section, enter another section, stuff like that. You don't need that for a simple ini file format. It also knows how to deal with multiple files. When you have, for example, system global configuration here, site-specific here, user-specific there. It can handle them all. It's just like it had three different sections, just like that. You can describe all those things for the ini agent. But in this case, we use a shortcut we call sysconfig file. It looks like a sysconfig file. It's handled like a sysconfig file. and you simply pass the path to that thing, and that's it. And this now enables us to read and write that kind of file. It looks like that. This is a lot of copy and paste. It's not very beautiful from a software engineering point of view, but it demonstrates what happens. We have an SCR read with that path I had in that agent, like etc sonic sonic underscore server underscore conf dot, and then the variable inside the file, port public max underscore players map here map. The reason why this is magenta is because that's a keyword in the Emacs model. Don't bother. Then respawn time, now the others. Now, that SCR read might return any value. And that's a problem, of course. YCP is a type safe language. It's unlike Perl. Perl always tries to guess what data type you're dealing with. In YCP, you explicitly specify your data type. But for this situation, there is a data type called any. So that means it might be anything. You're allowed to transport it from one variable to the other, but you can't do anything more with it. If you want to do any specific operations on it, you cast it or convert it to some other type. This is why here I cast it to string. This is just the same as a cast in C, except that it's type safe. It's more like a dynamic cast in C++, because if it's not a string, you will get a runtime exception. You will get a complaint in the log file, and the result of that expression here will be nil. Nil is the YCP equivalent to a null pointer, except that the system doesn't crash, or the program doesn't crash when you get one. You can, it's legal and normal for any variable type to have the value nil. Even a string can be nil. Okay, for a string it even makes sense, because a string might be undefined. It's very similar to undef in Perl. Even Boolean variables can be nil. So they can have three values, true, false, or nil. So what I did here is simply use a string variable for every one, every entry of this, cast it to string like that, assign it to a string variable. Of course, there really are all string variables. This is why when building the dialog here, I have to do a number of type conversions. For example, port here is a string variable which doesn't make very much sense in the context, so I have to convert it to integer. The way I do it here is simple, but not exactly the safest thing to do in a production environment, because when somebody entered nonsense in the file, usually those people using the IO or their editor tend to enter nonsense at that point. You have some random characters inside the file, so you have a parse error at that point. So that two integer also would return nil, which would at that point make the widget complain at some later point, I can't handle a value nil here, do something with me. So the widget would return nil too, so the entire expression fields would be nil as well. This is something you want to avoid. This is just to demonstrate the principle. Checkbox is a Boolean. Public is also a string variable, like all the variables I used in this example. And the way I convert that to Boolean is I compare it to yes. If it has the text yes, then it means yes, obviously, Boolean true. Okay, we have reading, we have building the dialogue. Now, what is missing? Writing it back to file. Now,
in previous examples, we only had a basic user input statement that said, handle user input here. It didn't actually do very much because we simply ignored our user input. This is going to change now. The first part here is an input loop. This is a structure you usually see in all YCP scripts. We do user input, and user input returns something. We store that something into a variable called button. And button has type symbol. Symbol is a data type used for that thing, the strings with the backticks. This is when, in my opinion, but then I might be biased, I've been used to that for 6 years now. In my opinion, this is a bit easier to read than comparing button against a string here. It's also a matter of type safety, because when I screw something up at this point, this will get me an error in the log file rather than getting simply silently ignored, and I never know what happens and why my program doesn't react to a button press. So, user input is repeated here until the user hits accept or the user hits cancel. This now does not mean that with every character I type in the dialog, usually that user input would return. User input is, by default, a very high-level thing. By default, it only returns when the user clicks or activates a push button. If you wanted to react to other events, you can, but you have to specify that explicitly. For example, and this is very typical to everyday use of those things, you open a dialog, you have a number of widgets where the user can enter his things, but he's not really interested in every single key press. Let him enter his name in the name field, his password in the password field. I only want to know when he's finished doing that, and I can read the dialog content and store them to some other place. This is the usual use of that. Also with selection boxes. When I have a selection box, I usually want the user to select stuff until he's done selecting, and then tell me, okay, I'm done now. And this is usually what happens with a key press. I can tell every widget to return on every kind of event. I can do that on a very fine-grained level, but usually you don't want that. You don't want to handle that kind of information for simple scripts. And this, again, is a good reason for using all that stuff in the first place, because you don't want to deal with that level of detail with simple scripts like that. Read configurations, store them in widgets, let the user input. When it's finished, then let's write this stuff back to file. And this is what's happening here in the next part. If we hit the accept button, if the user hit the cancel button, then simply nothing will happen. We'll simply throw away all the values. But if he hit the accept button, then the content of all the widgets and store them in variables. I now reuse the variables I defined earlier in the program. Reading stuff from a widget happens with a call query widget. Widgets have properties. Properties are usually obvious things like the value of whatever is stored right now in a property, but they also have stuff like a label, that's a caption above the widgets. Most YCP widgets do have captions. They can have any number of properties, and query widget is a very generic way to query all kinds of properties from a widget. But usually you are interested in value. We have a consistent naming scheme, so its value is usually the thing you would expect. A value of a text entry, text input field, is what the user entered. And the value of checkbox is, well, the true or false state. But again, since we have to want to write it back to file, and it's I need string format for all that. I need to do some type convert. Okay, but I begin with public here. Query widget of checkbox will get me a Boolean value. But I don't want a Boolean value or want a string. I want to store yes or no inside the file. So what I use here is a question mark operator just like in C and return yes or no. Now, converting something to string, there are several ways to do that, but the most convenient is sformat. Sformat is very much like strictf. So you can format basically everything, except that for one thing, it cannot crash. For another, it will convert everything. It will convert the craziest kinds of data structures to string. That's very useful for debugging, actually, because you can throw everything into an S format and log it to the log file. So this is why the parameter it gets is %1. It's not %s, it's %1. %1, %2, %3, %4, %5, and so on. The reason for that is because usually that stuff gets translated, because this is something the user gets to see. And in different languages, the ordering within sentences might be different. This is something we know in Europe. I mean, we know that it matters that more than Pacific Daylight Time dollars and 7-bit ANSI is being supported. This is why we took care to give the translator a chance to rearrange the variable parts inside strings. And this is done with that %123. Okay, of course, in this example, this is very trivial. I only want that thing. But the string might contain percent also. So I don't put it here directly, but I say %1 and then put into it whatever query widget returns. As an additional confirmation now for the user, I post a pop-up dialog that says, okay, where is written to and then complete path. We have the push button. Push button can have a widget option. Widget options are, well, slight modifications to the default behavior. And default means when the user hits return, then make the dialogue be done at this point. This is what off default here does. Yes?
It's not automatic, the colors.
This?
No,
off default?
Excuse me, on the shirt. Yes. If you put the ampersand instead.
It would do the same thing automatically at this point. You would get a warning in the log file, yes. We do warn people when they don't provide reasonable default shortcuts, because it can be awkward to read when crazy letters have the ampersand or get assigned to the one. Okay, again, same techniques. Open the dialog. Now, I use timeout user input, which returns with a special value timeout after the specified time. It's milliseconds, that's why 4,000 here. And then I close the dialog. It also closes the topmost dialog. Dialogs are always arranged on stacks, so you always only handle the topmost dialog. One important thing to note, we read out values from the widgets up above here. But of course, that only works as long as the widgets exist. It's a common error for people to close the dialog and then try to query the widget. But then, of course, the widgets are destroyed, the user input is gone. That doesn't work. This is why the corresponding closed dialog to the initial open dialog way, way up above is only here at the very end. Okay, speaking of the very end, the time is now at the very end. I have some more example where I refined that some more to demonstrate functions and using lists and maps, but I fear we ran a little bit out of time now. So maybe let's do some cool Q&A at this point. And if somebody is interested in how to deal with functions, lists, maps, and so on, we can do that outside on the booth. Is that okay with everybody? Okay, so questions? You were first.
If I use suse config, basically I write down etc suse config configuration file, and how can I call suse config afterwards? To take the changes?
For calling suse config, we have a predefined YCP script. You can call that with a call function. Call function and then in suse config. That's it. It will also give you the dialogue and so on, so the user has some feedback.
And what has to be done on this suse config end? Do I have to write another module?
You would have, if you need your changes to be propagated into the system, of course, we would also need another suse config module, yes. Because you have to deal with the situation where the user did not use graphical interface, but he runs suse config manually, yes.
Okay.
Okay. Then you have to ask
me. I don't have to understand. When at the beginning, when you read the file, you don't cast it into the right type directly. Why do you go by string and next?
You mean
yes.
Here?
Yes.
At this point, this is what I was about to show in the next example. This is for simplicity. I use it a string. This is a fringe case actually, because I'm not sure if the inner agent is aware of any types here. It might depend if you enclose your numbers in quotes, for example, then you would get a string. If you don't, then you get an integer. And then you would want to deal with both cases, because some users prefer to put it in quotes, some don't. So it's a bit more safe like this. Okay? Any more? Yes?
Is there any guidelines or style guides for YAS scripting to make them acceptable for giving a map on the page? Minimum requirements to have a script be accepted to be part of YAS.
I feel this goes a bit beyond this presentation. This script here is very basic. It does not have such things as internationalization support, where I would need underscore around each thing. It does not have support for outer YAS, which would be the next step to explain here. Outer YAS requires an interface where you can transparently read values and write values, because this is basically what outer YAS is all about. And outer YAS during system configuration time, when outer YAS runs to configure a system, only uses the read and write parts and not the dialogue part. So it's a bit more complex. The basic idea of this is to get people started and, well, to lose the terror of a new programming environment. If it's getting it into real production YAS code, is involves a lot more work. But you will get to this point if you follow this path. But this is where we would need something like a 3-day or 1-week tutorial. I think this goes way beyond the scope of this. I know that the answer isn't really satisfying.
Suppose I write a very beautiful YAS script to have
network logging on specific hardware. I know it would be a very good use to other users who use the same hardware. Is there any repository or minimum guides to make
would ask you to write down your ideas and to mail that to one of the Yast mailing lists. We have a Yast mailing list on an external mailing list on ForgeNovell.com. And there are some Yast hackers around, and they will forward it to whoever is closest to whatever you're trying to do. And then we could start a discussion on that level. Other than that, I don't want to promise too much here. I only want to promise things I can keep. Okay? Any more questions? No? Everybody happy? Or everybody dozed off? Okay, then, let's finish at this point. Thank you very much.